News from DC. The renegade, Joseph Robinette Biden, has indicted the proconsul, Donald John Trump. This month's public grain has been brought to you by Pepperidge Farms, Public Millers. The Pepperidge Farms only use the finest flour, true American bread for true Americans. And podcast news from the East. Remember, Shuffle has done an episode with the noble, patriot podcaster Mike Duncan, host of the History of Rome.
All mockery of Jews and their one God shall be kept to an appropriate minimum.
It's Britney, bitch.
And Iraq, everywhere like such a...
I'm supposed to be the franchise player, and we're in here talking about practice.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
Out, Charlie!
Our next door neighbors are foreign countries.
I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you. Now watch this drive.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Remember Shuffle, a podcast about 2000s pop culture, politics, and history. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is my co-host, Jordana.
Hello, hello.
Today, we are joined by an OG podcaster, truly, Mike Duncan of the History of Rome and Revolutions podcast.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, Mike.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're fond of saying on the show that the 2000s were the dumbest decade for culture in recent memory. Given our topic and guest this week, we may have to tweak that little mantra to the worst decade for culture since the 40s BCE. We are discussing, of course, HBO's Rome, which ran from 2005 to 2007 and retold the story of the fall of the Roman Republic, along with nice, healthy doses of matriarchal intrigue and buddy cop soldiering. It was the most expensive TV series ever made at the time. It was tragically canceled before it had time to truly pop off and flourish. Jordano, why are we doing this show?
Well, much like Master and Commander, Rome's true strength is in the vibe, in immersing you in what it was like, or at least a plausible representation of what it was like to be in Rome at this time, and to see how alien it is from our own modern world and how interesting it is to see how these people thought and behaved.
Yeah, as we'll get into, it really goes hard on Roman religion and superstition in a really interesting way. And I think it's interesting to look at these because, as we've said before on our episode about Robin Hood, the sword and sandal genre was huge in the 2000s, and it's something that's kind of gone away. This was a pillar of Hollywood filmmaking generally in a way that it just is not anymore. Mike, you told us you've recently rewatched Rome. What do you like about this show?
Yeah, I had not seen it since it was active, or I think maybe I rewatched it back in the History of Rome days. But then I have a friend of mine who's getting extremely Rome-pilled right now.
Nice.
Which is great to see. Great. We're encouraging her. And she was about to dive into it. And I was like, you know, I have not seen this show in forever. Like, I wonder what I even think about it anymore. So yeah, I fired it up and I probably watched them all. Well, I made it through the second half of the second season and then kind of petered out as the show itself does.
Yes.
But yeah, I remember I actually have had kind of a negative-ish relationship with HBO's Rome, which is a very weird thing. I'm a little bit more down on it than a lot of people are. But in rewatching it, I was like, right, there are tons of things in this show that I love and only a few things that I'm really annoyed at. And it was the things that annoyed me that started looming larger the further I got away from it from my last rewatch. So I think the casting is fantastic. Like, the guy who plays Caesar is great. Great. Mark Antony is great. Young Octavian is great. Young Octavian really captures this sort of just cold fish sociopath that kind of is kind of coming up in the super like the womanizing style of Caesar versus Octavian, who has to be dragged to a whorehouse to lose his virginity, which is a whole plot point in one of the episodes.
Yep.
But yeah, I really think the characters, the performance of those characters is really the thing that keeps you going. And it is meant to be a TV show. So if these people weren't good or they weren't likable, or they weren't doing a good job, then I think we would all lose interest with it, even if it's talking about some of the most interesting people and events in like world history. So that's the thing that jumped out at me right away, was like, right, I love all of these people. They're great.
Yeah, even like if you pull up statues of these characters, some of the actors look exactly like those marble busts. I think the older Augustus, Agrippa, either Agrippa or Maecenas, I think one of those two is just, it's the guy made flesh.
Right. Yeah, Agrippa's got a little bit of like Samwise Gamgee's energy.
Yes.
Which was always a little off, didn't quite hit with me, because I love Agrippa. Mm-hmm. I famously, in the history of Rome, sort of drifted into man crushing on Agrippa a few times. And I'm definitely a bigger Agrippa stan than I am Augustus stan, because I don't think Augustus gets it. Augustus and Maecenas do not accomplish a lot. Augustus with just Agrippa accomplishes a lot. And if Agrippa had just wanted to go do his own thing, he might have been able to pull off some stuff too, because he was great.
Yeah. And before we really get going digging into the show, I have a quick disclaimer from my end. So this episode might be a little bit different than the ones we've done before, because one of the two of us actually has some credentials in classics. We launched Remember Shuffle when I was finishing up a PhD in classics at, let's just say, a large university in the Northeast. I have yet to say this on the pod for a couple reasons. Number one, I didn't want my students finding the podcast where I make jokes about Bill Clinton being a sex criminal. I thought that might not be good for professionalism reasons. And two, sometimes I felt like being a grad student was a fundamentally shameful position. More shameful even than being a podcaster. So I'm very, very happy to be out of that world. Yeah. But this is an episode where one of us actually kind of sort of knows what he's talking about. And we're joined by another expert in the form of Mike Duncan. So, yeah, you might learn something this episode. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but I'm a grad school dropout turned podcaster because, yeah, as you say, on the social hierarchy, podcaster is somehow superior to grad students. Is that the thesis on the table here?
Yes, correct. Okay. So let's start with the vibes, the setting. Like Master and Commander, this is a show about what it would be like to be in first century BCE Rome in so many ways. And there are just so many details. When they made HBO's Rome, this was a joint production between HBO, I believe the BBC, and an Italian film production agency. They built a scale replica of the Forum in Italy that still stands to this day. Mm-hmm. The only part of the set that does not stand is, appropriately, the poor part of town, which burned down in a fire, which is so perfect.
As one does.
Yeah. And when you watch this show, it tells you the story of the civil wars that ended the Roman Republic. Sure. It's a story that a lot of people are probably going to be familiar with, even if they haven't dabbled in classics. Maybe you had to read Julius Caesar in your high school English class, or even the Antony and Cleopatra, a deeper Shakespeare cut. But the narrative is kind of familiar, but you've probably never seen it presented this way in terms of the morality systems of these Romans, their spirituality, their institution. This show wants to stress that these people are unimaginably different from you. Even if they're speaking English and making some jokes, the show gets across the ubiquity of slavery, for instance. There are slaves everywhere. There's a scene where Attia of the Julii is having sex with Mark Antony, and when they finish, she says, "Water," and it cuts to slaves who have been in the room the entire time. Or you have Julius Caesar has his slave accountant bookkeeper named Posca, who speaks with a Greek accent, which is such a nice little touch. And they have this interesting banter-heavy relationship. In terms of the other ways that this show is different, their sexual mores are so different from ours. And some of this is for sure exaggerated, as we'll get into when we talk about some of the gratuitousness, but they stress how generally comfortable with violence everyone is in this world. And I think in an age where we're dealing with the trad statue avi posters about facts and logic and Western civilization and reason and all that, that goes all the way back to Rome, I mean, you see that these are not gleaming statue logic and facts and reasons people. These people are doing voodoo pretty much every day. They're engaged in some kind of religion, superstition. They're writing curse tablets at all times. And yeah, I don't want to beat the dead horse here, but much like Master and Commander, it really is about the vibe of ancient Rome.
I agree with that 100%. And obviously that is the true strength of the show, and also why the show didn't go on, because they spent so much money immersing us in this world that, it was too good for this world then. And we talk about the past as a foreign country, right? And it is like an alien world. And I do think that that's true. They are all still, like, people are always going to be recognizably people too. People are falling in love. They have humor. They feel betrayed. You want to help a friend. Like, there are very recognizable human traits in there. But one of the things that struck me when I was going through the history of Rome was that the Romans, as you pointed out, like, they hated being alone. They couldn't stand the idea of being alone. And they would have slaves sleeping in their quarters with them. If you went to bed, you weren't ever actually physically distant from very many people. And I do think that from time to time, they really do get at the kind of claustrophobia. I think we would probably feel claustrophobic living in this world, constantly surrounded by people, the crush of people at all times. Rome was a crowded city, but it still wasn't like enormous. It's just that people were living right on top of each other at all times. And I do think that that is a very different thing. But also, we're all thinking about people. And people, I hesitate to say that there are such things as, you know, a universal human nature, because you don't want to get too far down that line. But like, are people always going to be making music and dancing to music? Are they going to be falling in love with each other and lust with each other? Yeah. And then, you know, the other thing, you're like the sort of people viewing the Romans as these upright, chaste, rational creatures. Like, no, these were very horny people.
Yes.
Who were constantly in and out of each other's beds the entire time and acting for very irrational reasons and basing decisions on very, like, the chickens didn't go a certain direction. And so we shouldn't have a battle today, or the guy who kicked the chickens off the boat and that's why they lost the battle. This is very irrational stuff. Mm-hmm. This is not capital R hashtag rationality with a trademark symbol next to it. And they do a really good job of that. Although they do trend into, because I did a treatment for The Storm Before the Storm that I was trying to shop around. And there were some things that I was trying to do different than Rome. And Rome has this very, like, the Romans as stiff upper Brits is kind of a thing that's been really current in the 20th century, because the British Empire kind of got mapped as the Roman Empire kind of in cultural memory. So if you want to have aristocratic Romans, they always look and sound like they live in London and go out for the weekends to their place up in Yorkshire.
Yeah, I mean, look at Brutus in this show, who talks with what I call the pith helmet accent.
Yeah, exactly.
Get this man a gin and tonic on the veranda.
Yeah, so this is a bunch of stiff upper Brits walking around cosplaying as Romans. So at some point I want to do, and so one of the pitches for the series that I was going to do is I really wanted to make them a bunch of Italians, which is more or less what they were and how they behaved, and to take a few more cues from Italian and Italian American cinema as opposed to BBC and high Shakespearean culture, because that's a lot of the way that these Roman stories, like you said, Julius Caesar, comes to us through people like Shakespeare. And so we have this impression of them as being a bunch of Shakespearean actors, basically.
Yeah. Right. That makes sense. We've talked on this show before. We were watching Prince of Persia with a German roommate of ours, and he asked, I don't understand, why do they have British accents? And we had to explain, like, it's because it's the past. That's how people behaved.
That's exactly.
How everyone in the past, everyone is British.
Or conversely, like, oh, well, that's a bad guy. which happens like a lot. Like, why does that guy have a British accent? Oh, well, he's the bad guy.
Right.
Yeah. But it's an educated bad guy, right? That's the thing. Yes. It's the high culture bad guy is always going to have a British accent.
The banality of evil style bad guy.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. No, I love your point about, these are human people with human stories that just have this different outlook from you. Like, there's a moment in season two, which, as you said, is the weaker of the two seasons, but Varanus is invited to a symposium at Attia's house, and he feels inadequate. He's like, oh, I can't go there. It's like, wow, there's literally a wine track of parties. He's a beer track guy, and he doesn't feel like he's good enough for it. Yeah, this guy who's this accomplished warrior, rigid in his morality, also feels a little insecure around the upper crust, you know?
Yeah, well, Varanus has got lots of problems.
Yes.
He's got a lot of hangups. Let's get over to a plot summary. And we're not going to go into extreme detail here, but if you're a listener, you should know that there are basically three main threads in the plot. The first is the plot of the upper class men, which covers the historical narrative that you're probably most familiar with. You know, so Julius Caesar is returning from Gaul. A civil war breaks out between him and Pompey and the Senate. Caesar wins, is stabbed, pizza. Mark Antony feuds with the Senate. And then eventually Augustus feuds with them and wins. And so in short, each season tells the story of a Roman civil war. Another one of the main threads is the conflict between the upper class women of Rome. We have Attia of the Julii, who Ben mentioned is an amalgam of several different women of the era, and is an Octavian's mom. And she's maneuvering her family's social standing through this civil war that's occurring in Rome and feuding with the matriarch of the Junii. And sort of in like a Arrested Development style, Lucille 1, Lucille 2 conflict in first century BCE Rome.
Yeah, they're very close friends who actually hate each other and aren't aren't actually friends at all, but pretend to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sometimes think that they're just being fake when they say that they're such good friends.
I'm starting to think.
But that's I picked up on that. That might be not something that a lot of people pick up on, but like my suspicion is that maybe they were being a little fake with each other.
Yeah.
Fake friends in first century Rome.
Yeah, big time frenemies.
But the best plot line, I think, is the Titus Pullo and Lucius Verenus plot line. These are two invented characters. They are real names that are name dropped in Caesar's commentary on his wars in Gaul as two especially brave soldiers, but their characters are totally made up. And I like to think of them as murderer Forrest Gumps because they're violent men who do lots of murders, including at one point literally murdering Cicero, which I found a very, very funny scene. But these two guys, these two fictional lower class plebeian soldier types, bounce around the first century BCE, and they are somehow always not only around history when it happens, but like accidentally driving it forward in a kind of Forrest Gump, Mr. Magoo style interaction with history. Like the second episode is called How Titus Pullo Brought Down the Republic.
Yes.
Because of a gambling debt that he had, or a feud around gambling, someone takes a swing at him and is mistaken for a swing at Caesar, and this kicks off the whole thing. And this happens like at least half a dozen times in this show.
Yeah, they really leaned into these two guys are just the walking little butterfly effect of history. Wherever they go, yes, and flap their wings, that's which way history goes.
Mm-hmm. It kind of made me think of your episode on Francisco de Miranda, just seeming to always show up in some aspect of one of the revolutions
yes,
in the 18th and 19th century.
But Miranda was real. People do often ask me like if I just made him up because I was running out of content that week. And the answer is no, Miranda is real. He actually did all of those things.
And the other great thing about these two guys is that they are very funny. This show has, sometimes it has a dry, understated British style of humor. Like there's a scene where Atia is having a dinner party and they calmly discuss suicide. Oh, should I stab myself or should you kill me? Like, no, I would much rather kill myself, please. And it's like a Monty Python sketch almost. But the humor with Titus Pullo and Lucius Verenus comes from the fact that this is a buddy cop movie or show. One of them is this horny, aggressive, violent, well, I guess they're both kind of violent.
They're both violent.
Impulsive, emotional kind of guy.
Yeah, Pullo is a brute.
Yes, yes. Pullo's the brute. And Verenus, who's the sergeant, the officer, Pullo's officer, is this highly rigid, conservative pater familias, as we'll get into. He has some very strict ideas about gender roles.
He's very dogmatic in his beliefs on the Roman Republic and traditions, which plays out for comedy a lot.
So I do agree that their odd couple bickering is always mm-hmm. going to be good, right? I enjoy mm-hmm. it when they're kind of like annoying each other, but in a funny way. And I don't even necessarily dislike the fact that they kept going back to the well of these two guys aren't just present for things, but actually the cause of things on top of everything else, right? Okay, mm-hmm. it's a convention, it's a show, it's a fun show, like we're enjoying ourselves. But now is the time where I have to go on record and say that I hate Lucius Verenus. I hate yeah. Verenus. I think he sucks. And I have never quite understood why it is that everybody latched on to him in particular. And I get their dynamic is fun because odd couple relationships are fun. But Verenus especially is one of the most thoroughly contemptible protagonist characters that I have ever come across in film or TV. And whenever he shows up and does something, I'm like, that was a stupid thing for you to say. Why are you being such a jerk to them? Why are you being so harsh on those people? And mm-hmm. people will say about, oh, well, they're Romans and they have different morality. And so you just don't understand that he's representative of something here. But all of the characters are Roman. Everyone mm-hmm. in this show is a Roman and being portrayed as a Roman. So the fact that Verenus is behaving the way that Verenus does, his behavior leads his wife to commit suicide and then all of his children to be murdered because of how yeah. bad he sucks as an individual and as a human being. So my sort of contempt for Verenus, which stands in stark contrast to the HBO Rome fan base out there, and probably a lot of mm-hmm. people who are listening to this right now are like, what, Mike Duncan hates Verenus? Is this actually real? This is very real, guys. And the mm-hmm. thing that I sort of had forgotten when I went back to rewatch it is that this position that I have where I don't like Verenus and I don't like any of the things that he does and I think that he sucks, that kind of ballooned larger in my my memory. And then when I rewatched it, I was like, oh yeah, but he's only part of it. And then of these three plot lines that we've got going on, I think all the stuff about the fall of the Republic, all the high politics is great, right? They do a really good job with it. And it's fun. The matriarchal feuding, that might be my favorite bits. Anytime.
Really?
Yeah. I love that stuff. It's great fun. And I think that's a great, like, she's a great sort of villain-ish character, right? She's primarily an antagonist towards many other people. And I don't think you ever really walk away feeling like Atia is a good person or that you should necessarily be rooting for her. But she's, I think, better in that way than somebody like Varinus, who's meant to be a protagonist, right? We're not meant to hate Varinus. I'm not meant to walk away from this characterization of him being like, I don't like this person. I'm meant to think of him as a protagonist. And so in that way, I think Atia is fun to watch in a way that when Varinus shows up and it's just him being a dick to his family, I'm like, do I hit the fast forward button? Because I can just skip this.
Yeah, it's tough to watch for sure. And it gets a lot worse in the second season too, I think. Because I think in the first season, they try and soften him towards his family, right? They try and have an arc where he's going to be nice to Niobe or what have you.
Which lasts like two lines of dialogue. And then he goes right back to being a huge asshole to her. Like, I don't... And then she's sticking with him because she's so in love with him? Because she's so in love with this guy? I don't know. I don't know about these characterizations, fellas.
Yeah. It's the worst in season two when he gets totally blackpilled. After the kids are gone.
Yeah.
And towards the end of season two, they do bring them back. It's revealed that they're not killed, but they were enslaved.
The kids weren't killed. Yeah. I dropped off. I didn't finish the second season before we did this. So the kids weren't actually killed. He just thought that they were dead and then went on.
He rescues them.
And they rightfully hate him because he literally cursed them, right?
Yeah. Because he's a horrible person. Yeah. There's the scene where the kid who is the kid of whatever the lover that she had taken while he was off in golf for like a decade. And you think, oh, he's going to maybe be like, look at this horrible thing that I've done. Maybe I should change my thinking about something. And no, he just rejects the kid and curses him. It's like, okay, whatever, Varinus.
Yeah, I mean, patriarchy is real. But I agree with you that I don't know what the show wants us to think about Varinus. Because sometimes I did think that what HBO was trying to show was like, listen, man, patriarchy is real. Pater familias is real. Mm-hmm. This is what that looks like, warts and all.
Right.
Power of life and death over your family. Honor killings. And I think that's a really good demystifying approach to Rome also. But I think you kind of hit the nail on the head where like sometimes the show treats it with a very light touch. It's meant to be like, oh, this is your buddy Varinus. He's with Polo. He's a protagonist. We're rooting for him.
We're absolutely meant to be rooting for them. And seeing his rebuilding the relationship with Niobe is meant to be something that we feel positively disposed towards. And then it's meant to have this tragic end. But the thing is, I just don't feel like the way that the character was written and the lines of dialogue that they have and the scenes that they have portraying all this really ever does. Like, at least Pulo's got his own problems, right? In terms of characterizing this person who fell in love with a woman, wanted to marry her, found out that she had a different guy, literally smashed that guy's head into a wall repeatedly until he died. And then the woman that he loves walks in on this and sees all of this. And then I believe the very last shot of the season, which is like maybe two episodes later, is Pulo and that woman walking hand in hand because now they're just in love as husband and wife. And then the next season, they're just sort of like a married couple. And it's like, oh, I'll kiss you when you shave. Go. They're having these like little jokes. It's like, do you not remember that he bashed the love of your life's head in like repeatedly until it was nothing but goop? And then you walked in on it and saw it. And I'm supposed to believe that these two are now just like a happy little married couple who cute bicker with each other? I don't know.
Yeah. It's the couple at the party. You really don't want to ask them how they met.
Yeah.
You don't want to hear that story.
It was not a meet cute, man. It was meat involved, but it was on the floor because it had been spilled out of his head. Oh boy.
Yeah.
Varinus and Pula. This is my big thing with me and the HBO Rome fan base is that these two guys, when I think about their arcs, and the thing is, it's the bit that the writers are making up. So when the writers are sticking to the source material, I feel like the show is really, really great. But then when they sort of start to go off and do their own thing, I start to have issues with what I'm meant to feel about these people.
I think it is kind of in the HBO DNA, because I remember a similar phenomenon with Game of Thrones where, like,
yeah, for sure,
when they go off the books, the whole show goes off the rail. But I remember I stopped watching Game of Thrones after the third time that they changed consensual sex in the books to rape, like on screen rape on the TV series.
Yeah.
Where I was like, that's it. I'm done.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Something's up with this writer's room.
Yeah. They keep coming back to this. Yeah. I've got a no rape rule if I ever get a writer's room that, like, yeah, we've done it. It's over. We don't need to do this anymore. You know, like, I've got a treatment for a French Revolution show that I would love to do at some point, and rape would be a very easy way to be like, oh, let's find a way to punish a female character and have her go through pathos and show what a, you know, a gross inequal society looks like. But I think Game of Thrones, yeah, pretty much put all of that to bed. There's no reason to show it anymore anyway.
Yeah.
Although Mark Antony rapes a woman in this show, which is played for laughs, by the way, where they're like on a baggage train or like some kind of traveling convoy, and they have to wait because Mark Antony is off by a tree, like having, I mean, maybe it was consensual sex. Mark Antony, I'm told, is a bit of a snack by Lady Rome fans in my life, that he's maybe a problematic fave, but I'm pretty sure we saw him rape a woman and have it be a bit playful laughs.
I didn't know what you had said about the HBO fan base, that they were rooting for Varinus so much. And this is a 2000s podcast, and I think that this probably happens a lot in the 2000s with anti-hero figures because they are becoming so popular. You know, it took 7 seasons for Sopranos fans, a lot of them anyway, and they still don't even know, to be like, of David Chase repeatedly being like, Tony is a bad man. He is not a good guy. You should be rooting against him. And it just took 7 seasons of him becoming worse and worse and worse. And even still, people didn't really take him in as being someone you should root against. So maybe Varinus just needed 5 more seasons of becoming more depressing.
Yeah, for us to recognize that from the beginning, he's meant to be an anti-hero.
Right.
And maybe I'm misreading it. And maybe if the people who wrote the show are listening to this, maybe they can send me like a very angry email of how I'm misreading their text. But I definitely feel like Varinus's conflicts in the society that he's in is sort of portrayed as he's really strongly virtuous, right? He's very morally upright. And like I say, he has these conservative values, you know, it's honor and fidelity and patriarchy and chastity, right? Like, he's offered the opportunity to impregnate Cleopatra and passes on that because he's too faithful to the wife that he clearly kind of hates. So I don't think that he's a Walter White, Tony Soprano, Vic Mackey kind of character, which if you watch The Shield, for example, from the jump, Vic Mackey is a horrible person from beginning to end. And even if, every once in a while you're like, I kind of want him to get away with this caper because guys getting away with capers is fun. I don't think we're ever left feeling like, oh, this is a good person. But I think they're kind of suggesting that with Varinus, that he actually is, because he has these religious principles and these moral principles and his faith in the Republic, as everybody else is descending into cynicism and greed, that he's like, no, the institutions of the Republic are what bind us together. I do think that they're trying to rest a little bit of the moral center of the show on this guy who I don't like very much.
Yeah, and even one of the last episodes is he helps Mark Antony kill himself, and it's meant to be like, look, he's doing his duty to the very end, right? He's a good little soldier.
Which there's a great scene at the beginning of season 2 when Antony comes to call Varinus out of his depression and turn him into a gangster, which is apparently the thing that got the most votes in the writer's room when they were like, well, what are we going to do with Varinus? Like, let's make him a psychopathic gangster.
I hated that arc. I hated Varinus running the Collegium, because at that point, he's just a black-pilled nihilist.
Yeah.
This guy who was mad that he had crossed the Rubicon with Caesar while unconscious is now just murdering people in the streets, doing prescriptions.
Yeah.
What happened here?
Well, what happens is that he drove his wife to suicide and then had all of his children get murdered. That's what happened to him. But what was I going to say? Oh, when Antony is coming to haul him out of his depression, he yells at him and he's like, why aren't you dead? Why haven't you killed yourself yet? If you're so upright and you're a true Roman, why are you still alive? And that, I think that's a really good question that Varinus did not have a good answer to, because he really should have killed himself like a couple of times.
Listener, if you have depressed friends, do not use this strategy. This only applies to Roman Stoics.
Exactly.
The next section we have here is just to go through some of the anachronisms of the show, just because I watched this with Ben, and every time he pointed something out to me, I was dying laughing, because Ben was able to identify a lot of anachronisms, which I I hadn't even thought about, but which I think are very funny. So I'll let Ben cook a little bit here.
Yeah, do it. Do it.
I mean, one throwaway one is Varinus has a pocket-sized fresco of his wife that he hates and accidentally drives to suicide, which it's a wallet-sized photo, but it's a fresco. It's like frescoes are painted on fresh walls, man. That's what the fresh in it means.
He's just carrying around a wall, like on a chain behind him, so he can remember the wife that he hates every time.
Yeah. In the second episode, Pullo says, I'm going to drink all the wine, smoke all the smoke, and fuck every whore in the city. Smoke what, Pullo? Like, obviously, tobacco is a New World crop, and there are references to opium and hemp in some of the way later sources than this. Or not way later, but like Pliny the Younger and Galen, but not first century BCE. And there is a subplot where Octavia becomes something of a hemp addict, which is very, very funny. Ati of the Julii says, I appreciate these little chats we have between your drug binges. I did some research. Hemp has a 0.3% THC content. So you know how like some of the, like, the aging hippie boomers talk about how weed was less powerful in the 70s? It was way less powerful in the 50s BCE.
There were some mushrooms floating around the Near East. You know, the fabulous poppy plant has been known to druggies and dropouts the world over.
And I think that's what Cleopatra is meant to be smoking also.
Yeah, for sure.
But I think the Cleopatra portrayal is kind of schizophrenic. I think they get it better in season two than season one. Because when we first meet Cleopatra in season one, I think they're trying to go BPD art ho is the energy that they're looking at.
Right. She's, sounds right.
But in season two, they portray her like a little bit more competent and whatever. And one that I love is they kill Caesar because they have to. It's a thing that happened. And one of the assassins shouts, thus ever for tyrants.
Yes.
Okay. Right. Sic semper tyrannis.
Yes.
And this is not real Latin from the ancient world. The Latin from the Seal of Virginia, I heard this at a talk at a conference back in my academic days. The Latin on the Seal of Virginia came from a Latin translation of Thucydides' Peloponnesian War. And it was in Pericles' funeral oration when he's talking about what makes the Athenians so great. And he said, we always remain hostile to tyrants. And the people who were crafting the State Seal of Virginia just grabbed those three words and then famously shouted by John Wilkes Booth after Lincoln got assassinated, and now it's found its way back into this pretend ancient world. It's like some kind of weird Mobius strip of these words looping around upon one another. But Mike, do you have a favorite ahistorical anachronistic inaccuracy that just makes you chuckle from the show?
Yeah, I'm never going to be as strong with this material culture anachronisms. I do the politics, I do the people interacting with each other, but sometimes a movie will come out and people are like, can you believe this? They're wearing the wrong sandals. And I'm like, I'm not actually super well versed in what sandals legionaries were wearing. That's never really of my interest. I think I just glossed over the fact that he opened up a wallet and there was a wallet sized fresco. It's like, oh yeah, he's looking at his wife who he hates. Okay, so what were mine though? So great one is classic. Okay, so Cato the Younger, he's younger mm-hmm. than most of these people.
Mm-hmm.
Cato was born in 95 BC. Caesar was born in 100. Pompey was 106. Cicero was born in 106. And then there's like a younger generation of Brutus and Cassius and Antony who were all born in like the mid 80s BC.
Mm-hmm.
And so Cato's really coming in right in between those. And this is something that it is an anachronism that they have him being played by this crotchety old man, because Cato the Younger represents the crotchety old manness of the thing. So I feel like even if I was making a show about this, even I would be tempted to be like, yeah, just make him a crotchety old man because it works. But it is important to remember that Cato the Elder was in fact younger than most of his senatorial contemporaries.
Mm-hmm.
And then the one that I actually, this one got me at the time, was in the second season, at the beginning of the second season, so like right after the assassination, they want to continue with this characterization of Mark Antony as an impulsive soldier, right? Really, he's seeing red, and Octavian is going to be this cool, collected, rational strategist in terms of how they're going to go forward. So they flipped who did what immediately after the assassination, where really it was Antony who was playing a pretty close game and being conciliatory towards the Senate and trying to reach a settlement with them to try to maintain most of the structure intact. Like, he was on the verge of having a formal settlement with them. And then it was Octavian who came in and crashed around and wrecked everything and was like, Mark Antony's not going to try to prosecute the enemies of our fallen father, all this stuff. I understand why they reversed it in the show, because those are the characterizations they wanted to have. But that one is definitely one that sort of leaked out at me.
Yeah.
I do think just in general, when we do these historical movies and TV shows and we talk about authenticity and we talk about realism, a lot of the times when the people who make these shows, like, I'm going to make the most realistic version of this time period or this event, a lot of that comes from like the settings, the costumes. We're paying enormous amounts of attention to detail to those things, which I think is great. But then being like, oh, well, what actually happened doesn't fit with the story that I want to tell. So I'll rearrange what actually happened and what people actually did. But as long as the costumes are perfect, then we can say this is a very authentic show. And I kind of have the reverse mentality of that, where I want to see true fidelity to the facts and to the events, at least as we know them, which is something that I think that, for example, I, Claudius, right, does very well, where even if Tacitus himself or if Cassius Dio are exaggerating and embellishing beyond the facts, at least I, Claudius, is hewing very closely to the stories. And a lot of the most grotesque things that you see in I, Claudius are directly out of Tacitus. Meanwhile, they're like on a cardboard cutout stage, the BBC, they're wearing bed sheets. You could probably see the Sears tag on it. And I'm not that interested in how good the togas look if the history is right. Whereas if the toga is immaculate, but you're not getting the history right, that's sort of when I run into those issues.
Yeah, 100%. They gum up everyone's age too. I was mad that Cato was so old.
He's so old.
And also, they could have really had some fun with his suicide, and they don't. But they portray Cicero as younger than he was at the time. Mm-hmm. They portray him as like a younger, almost upstart in this moment. And it's like, this is a man who has already been consul. He's already been exiled for what he did as consul. Yeah, a few folks' ages they tweak, and I think, like you said, it has to do with how they want to characterize them. But
It's like, I get it, but this isn't really right. Although the guy who played Cicero, I think I like it as a portrayal of Cicero, because I'm kind of down on Cicero a little bit, and I think of him more as a sort of a very pompous windbag.
Yes,
and they didn't do pompous windbag. They did sort of like weaselly shift with the wind guy, which. Mm-hmm. As an anti-Ciceronian, I did enjoy.
Yeah. Ben, I'm gonna move us along just to style, just to make sure we stay on track here. So yeah, next up, you know, we've mentioned it briefly at the top of the episode, but this show looks great. Having real props, you miss them so much when you watch something like this, because we all recently watched Rings of Power, and I feel like at times it felt like that was something that was missing from that show, is just this idea of actually having a physical world that these actors were in while it was being filmed. And everything was clearly CGI in that show, and I'm sure it was very expensive, but there is something, apparently human beings can tell the difference. I know that it looks great, but you can really tell that Rome that they're in was rebuilt, like physically with objects.
Probably not in a day, but really quickly.
That's such a good point. Because this series came out right before the great because when was this current? Do you know off the top of your head? Like, what were the years of this? It was like 01, 02?
To seven.
Yeah.
2005 to 07.
So, right. So, the Star Wars prequels have come out. Mm-hmm. Maybe Revenge of the Sith is coming out right in this time, but that's really going to kick off the MCU-ization of special effects and having everything be filmed on green screens. Whereas this show is being filmed on physical sets that they built, and they are interacting with real physical objects. And that is such a strength of this show. That's 100% true.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the house, the Attia the Julii's house is modeled on houses in Pompeii. Yep. And we get so much Roman graffiti in Latin in the background, which is such a nice touch. And I would say it's immersive because the show doesn't spoon feed you with period piece details. I hate to keep going back to this well for this comparison, but we all remember the Game of Thrones sex positions, where we go to the brothel with Littlefinger as he explains the houses of Westeros with gratuitous HBO nudity in the background. This show, I think by virtue of it being partially BBC and Italian, it just assumes you kind of know some history.
Yeah.
And like, sink or swim, buddy. Someone says, I think it's Servilia, Brutus's mother, said the people will never accept a tyrannicide unless the Brutus holds the knife, which is a reference to the founding of the Republic, but it's never spelled out.
Right.
For you.
They never say, remember how your father in the first book of Livy came and murdered the last king of Rome. And yes, mother, I do remember that from my lessons as a small child. And now I will live up to those lessons that I have been. Yeah. That's a really good point.
And like, there's a great scene where Varanus gives Pullo a history lesson. And he says, I wrote this down. Do you think Cincinnatus, Marius, or even the Gracchi would act like Mark Antony does? And Pullo just response, who? Which I see, love.
That's the thing. Even though those guys annoy me, if those two guys are talking to each other, I'm usually pretty entertained.
Yeah.
Which they should have read. Maybe Pulo should have read my book, right? Then he would at least know who the Gracchi and Marius are.
Yeah, yeah. The Storm Before the Storm, available wherever good books are sold.
That's right. That's right.
And even just to really harp on this style, the language, they include a few words of Latin. They have characters who end questions with ne, which is ne is this particle that in Latin you put at the end of a sentence to make it a question. You can kind of think of it as the Canadian a. Before the arena scene, someone says cave or cave with this one, which is Latin for beware. Cave canem, beware of dog, is on a famous mosaic in Pompeii. Yeah, Pompeii. But with all that being said, language knowledge not always on point. So Mark Anthony says che brutta figura at one point, which is 100% Italian. And a Greek mercenary appears to bark orders in Italian, opening with ragazzi. And then my HBO subtitle said speaks Italian. This is Lysander the Greek mercenary. So a few slips from such a conscientious show. Yeah. But my theory is that they got some kind of tax break from the Italian government.
And I'm very sympathetic, honestly, in the grand scheme of things, to anybody who's trying to do something like this, because people like you and me are going to nitpick it to death, right? And there's like 10 million decisions that you have to make, and you're going for different things, and you're being pushed and pulled different ways. So it is with a degree of fun that we find these things inside of Rome, because they tried really hard and they did a mostly great job.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, closing out our style thing, we got to talk about gratuitous HBO nudity a little bit.
Yep.
And listen, I'm not a Puritan. I'm not a prude. I don't mind, but some of this does feel like really pushing the 2005 cultural envelope. So like most egregiously, I think, with the incest plotline, which is nowhere attested in any ancient sources, but they have Octavian have sex with his sister,
right?
Because his sister was groomed by an older woman into doing this as part of the frenemy plotline. Yeah, I don't dig it. I don't like what it does to the character. I wasn't a fan.
Yeah, it seems to be a little pastiche from Nero and Caligula, where, like you were saying, that we things from other bits of culture get sort of backward coded into these characters. And so, number one, if you're going to make a sword and sandal movie or TV show, there needs to be at least some gratuitous sex. Otherwise, you're not hitting one of the key, one of the key markers of the genre. So I understand why they're slipping that stuff in there. But yeah, like, let's have some Caligula Nero stuff in here, because people think Romans and they think aristocratic Romans, and they're like, oh, well, they must be incestual. So let's just write it in there, even though, yeah, like, people say lots of mean things about Octavian. I don't remember that being one of them.
Yeah. If you wanted to have Caligula plotline HBO, you should have kept making the show until you hit Caligula.
Yeah. Oh, man, that would have been great. We're in season 26 of HBO's Rome. We just introduced Caligula. Like, oh.
When's this Rome show going to end? I got bad news for you, bud. It's nicknamed the Eternal City.
Yeah, man. Philip K. Dick said it. The empire never ended.
Just a quick editor's note here. I said there was copious gratuitous nudity and or pushing the mid-2000s cultural envelope in HBO's Rome, but I didn't really provide any examples other than the Octavius incest plotline. So I'm coming in on the edit just to read to you verbatim from some of my watching notes to hammer that point home. This is the raw, unedited, uncut shit that I was writing as I watched HBO's Rome. Mark Antony spitting facts with his penis out. God damn, Caesar straight up abusing women. And we got Mark Antony slapping Atia. Show does not shy away from displaying men hitting women. And we got peen. This show's pretty over the top with a gratuitous nudity and sexuality slash sensuality. Arbitrary and gratuitous shot of Atia of the Julii jacking it to remind you that it's not TV, it's HBO. Girl on girl grief kiss, because HBO. Also, low-key grooming right here. Servilia invites this teenage girl over to her house for weaving, oldest trick in the book. Pulo describes Cleopatra as, quote, wet as October, which is really funny. Something that only works in a soft Mediterranean climate. The cuts from Caesar Cleopatra fucking to his ex Servilia seducing her rival's daughter are kinda eye-rolly. Boy howdy, we sure are watching HBO, aren't we? And that's just some of the things from only the first season.
I think we're running a little bit long here, so should we hop on to themes next, Ben?
Yeah, let's do it, let's do it. And I'm really excited for the first one. We're talking about political change. I think if you made this show today, there would be a shoehorned, obnoxious, make Rome great again Trump analog. They would try to map contemporary politics onto ancient Rome. And I think that this show does a very good job of not really doing this. So it tells the story story of the fall of the Republic. And I think to put this in very simplistic terms, these politics don't map onto ours, right? The redistributive economic policies are put forward by some authoritarians. Mm-hmm. And the people who are always harping on the Republic are just oligarchs, right? Who do not believe in any kind of redistributive policies. It doesn't match on to our right-left binary that we have now. And I think the show thrives for that. Giordano and I actually disagree on this. I think that the show is pro-Caesar in its portrayal. Giordano thinks it's more pro-Pompey Cato. Mike, how do you think the show falls?
I tend to think of this as Augustan propaganda.
Okay.
Yeah, but very specifically because, you know, how we're saying that Pulo and Varinus do everything. So you have this show postulating that a Caesarion, who is Caesar's child by Cleopatra, was in fact fathered by legionary Titus Pulo. And that is exactly the kind of thing that Augustan propagandists would have spread far and wide in the Eastern Mediterranean and in the Western Mediterranean when trying to assert and make sure that Octavian's claims to being Caesar's true heir are not in any way, shape, or form challenged, because it's not even his kid. It's legionary Titus Pulo who did that. I was joking with this with a friend of mine who's getting Rome pilled. That, like, if you go ahead, like, let's go ahead like 1,000 years or something, and people are sifting through the sources on ancient Rome. It's like, well, we have this one text, but we only know it by the initials HBO. Like, we don't know who actually wrote it. But in this version, there was a legionary who actually fathered Caesar's child. But that would fall directly under Augustan propaganda. The reason why I feel this too is Caesar and Mark Antony are just more compelling. They get more screen time too. They're more compelling than sort of their senatorial adversaries. And so I feel like it's in that sense pro-Caesar more than pro-Senate. But I would love to hear, Giordano's, what do you think?
So yeah, so my thought as a layperson, I guess, was that when we're looking at Brutus specifically, and a lot of people on his side, these are people who seem to sincerely believe in their government structure. They had what looked to me like a local pride in the way that Rome's government operated and a civic responsibility to keep it that way. And so even if it would have been easier to go along with Caesar, to a certain extent, they felt this familial and patriotic duty to keep the Republic running. And so in that sense, I was like, oh, they're portraying Brutus as someone who is not only inspired by some kind of like personal ambition, but an actual sincere belief that the government structure that Rome had was special and deserved to be kept intact. That's why I thought the show sort of sided with the Republic a little bit.
Because you did walk out of it feeling and believing all those things because of what you got from the show.
You're right. Yeah. And maybe it was because of how I was feeling too, where I was like, oh, look at these people. They really believe in this stuff, you know?
And I mean, the show does give Brutus a pretty honorable death. That's one of the changes that they make, is both Brutus and Cassius kill themselves around the Battle of Philippi. But this suicide by legion that Brutus does is he strips off his armor and he walks into the opposing legion and he's stabbed kind of in much the same way that Caesar was stabbed, you know, unarmed in a crowd of men. So it kind of gets at that guilt that he might feel for his action as a nobleman. I think that there's something there, but yeah, I think Mike, I think the show trends pro-Augustan because so many of the sources are pro-Augustan.
Yeah.
When we meet late Mark Antony and he's got like the leopard print kimono practically and the eye shadow Egyptian.
This is all Augustan propaganda.
That's true.
Probably also true, but also Augustan. But the sheer fact of making the Battle of Actium a critical hinge point in world history is Augustan propaganda, right? That moment that we all believe is this is the moment when X, Y, and Z happened. Well, yeah, because that's what Augustus then spent the next 30 years convincing everyone of, like making birthday cakes with ships on them and trying to impress his family with it. But that's an I. Claudius reference.
Monumentalizing it.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Yeah.
But I mean, on the other hand, and again, this is why I think that the show is so good. I do think that the show does kind of portray Augustus as something of a villain by the end of it, which for the record is, I think, correct. My hot take answer, if anyone asks me for a favorite Roman emperor, is it's the one who should have been but never was, Julius Caesar, baby, number one. That's that's my answer.
No, Octavian is a horrible person. And one of the great rebrands in world history is Octavian, this sociopathic monster, becoming everybody's favorite Uncle Augustus, who's just jolly and benevolent and ruling over a peacetime world because he literally murdered all his enemies.
Yeah.
And they do get that. It is nuanced, right? They're very clearly not trying to pick sides here. They're doing what I think good writers do, which is try to figure out what people's motivations are and take them seriously, not just be like, oh, well, this person wants to keep up the Republic because he's a greedy oligarch who just doesn't care about anything. It's like, no, there's probably other motivations going on in there. And Caesar wasn't just motivated by a benevolent desire to improve the lives of Romans in a way that his senatorial colleagues were opposing. Like, he was a megalomaniac who wanted to be in charge of everything. That is also true. And I think you get that from him as well. So they honor everyone's motivations and then run them into each other, which I think is a really strong part of those bits of the show.
Yeah, and it's a level of nuance that, as I said at the top of the section, I don't think we would get today if they made a similar show like
right.
this.
Right. Well, when I make my Storm Before the Storm HBO miniseries, which if anybody's, you know, booking, well, if anybody out there is working in management, HBO, you should pay your writers, man, so we can end this strike. and then I'll get to the thing that I want to pitch you about this book. But let's, you know, brass tacks here. Let's quit being such greedy assholes. And
yeah, absolutely. Love it.
Like ending.
Mike, you anticipated one of our questions, which was, is there another period of civil strife you would like to see get a high budget miniseries production of?
Absolutely. It's the period between 146 BC and 78 BC, which roughly coincides with a certain Roman history book that was written by me several years ago. Yeah. I have a whole treatment. It's Marius and Sulla, which is great because you have Sulla as Marius's protege. So they're together from the beginning all the way to the end. Like, it, them two have a really great pathos ridden dynamic all through their period. And then if that show got popular enough, there was going to be then a prequel series.
Mm.
It would be a standalone miniseries that would be just the Gracchi. And that's how I want to do it. So do two seasons of Marius and Sulla, then do like a miniseries on the Gracchi, and then finish up the Marius and Sulla bits.
Nice.
Ben, we just finished an hour, so I just want to say, I think we're going to zip along to the contingency of history.
Yeah, we did kind of talk about this already. Like Mike said, Polo and Varinus are the walking, talking butterfly effect. And I think what the show does so well, if you imagine, I'm going to characterize schools of historical thought here. And I'm literally quoting another history podcaster, Dan Carlin. So we're getting at the simplest, most caricaturesque level. You might have a school of thought of history that sees history primarily being driven by great men, the so-called great men of history theory. And then in Dan Carlin's words, on the other side, you have your trends and forces, your, you know, whatever, economic kinds of forces that drive history, and there's less individual agency involved. And then in between the two, I guess you can just have random shit-ass luck. This is something like the Union finding the Confederate battle plans before Antietam in a field somewhere that all of history hinges on. And one of the things that Rome does so well is that you get all three of these arbitrary and, I stress, caricaturesque poles, where you have this kind of decadence is portrayed, which is something the Romans themselves saw going back to Sallust, but this kind of decadence of the aristocracy, their infighting with one another, all that kind of stuff. You also have your great men of history, the greatest to ever do it, Julius Caesar, who comes over and knocks over the whole thing. And then you have Titus and Polo in the middle. And the show does such a great job of weaving all of these things together, I think.
I agree with you. I do think that it is historically inaccurate that legionaries Titus Pullo and Lucius Varinus caused everything to happen, one shit after another. But yeah, I'm obviously, and I've said this many times in the podcast, is, you know, I'm with Marx, basically, that men make their own history, but they do not make it in circumstances of their choosing. And the trends and forces of history set up stages and backdrops and present actors to the stage, but then the actors on the stage are doing their own things. And it is often then in retrospect that the Battle of Actium, for example, gets turned into this huge, momentous, world-shifting event in a way that at the time, you know, nobody would have even known that. For sure, one of the things that I know about people like Caesar, people like Napoleon, are these are the luckiest bastards on earth, right? Caesar had multiple times that he should have been defeated, that he could have been defeated. Even after Pharsalus, he's got a battle up in Spain with Pompey's kid that was actually the closest run he came to being fully defeated in a battle. But the contingency was the luck of it, that things kept breaking Caesar's way until he got stabbed like a bunch of times by his best friends, which that's literally when his luck ran out. So even the reputation of great men is often an artifact of contingency factors that are well beyond even within their own control. Like, Caesar had a great ability to manipulate opinion and manipulate perception of things. And he was a very good commander. Of course he was. But the fact that he just didn't get beat in a couple of times, you know, it's like in sports, you know, it's like in baseball where a ball that lands 6 inches to the left of a glove, now suddenly this guy's like a great hero who comes through in the clutch. And if it had been 6 inches to the right, it gets caught. And now he's the goat and he sucks. But like, what the guy actually did isn't that different. The ball's basically on the same trajectory, headed in the same direction off the same pitch. It was just like a little bit here and there that's really outside of any of our capabilities. It's the gods that do it.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I like that the show, I think, makes an explicit reference to that, of Caesar being so lucky and being sort of touched by the gods, because he's trying to decide what to do with Varinus and Pullo. And he goes, I can't kill you because clearly the gods are interested in you.
I did want to talk about that scene. That's the writers telling us that this is a TV show, right? Because they are the gods that they're referring to, because Antony's like, you got to kill these guys. There's literally no reason on earth why you wouldn't be killing these people right now. So why aren't you killing them? And Caesar's like, the gods seem to have chosen these two to live through every episode and have at least 23 minutes of screen time according to their contract. So I can't kill them. But I thought that was actually a very nice, clever nod to remind us to suspend our disbelief a little bit here and just kind of enjoy. Because they had let Pompey go.
Yep.
We're literally like, we had him, but we let him go. And Caesar's like, okay, well, I'm going to promote you and make you a senator. I do love Caesar. I do love Caesar in the show. Yeah.
Oh, he's so good. He's my favorite historical figure that they do.
He's clearly so delighted with just playing Caesar. I love Rex Harrison. Actually, one of my very favorite movies is the Liz Taylor Cleopatra. I really, really love that. So Rex Harrison is always going to be high on my list of Caesar portrayals. But I forget, what's the guy's name? I forget what his name is.
He's Mance Rayder in Game of Thrones.
Okay. Oh, right. Yeah, he was sensational.
Also, the thing about, I think there's even a way you could see that scene as referencing a classical source, because the poet Lucan writes about how Caesar's patron deity was Fortuna, right? And he specifically says it's the gods and it's their luck, their fortune.
Yep.
I'm not going to kill someone favored by fortune. Nice little nod. Love it.
Yep.
So let's close out our Rome discussion by talking about what might have been. So as we've kind of gestured towards her this episode, I don't think it's controversial to say that the second season of Rome is far inferior to the first. There are some subplots that are thrown in there that don't really go anywhere. Like, there's a weird, almost proto-Zionism plotline involving Herod and some politicking that could be interesting, but is just not fully fleshed out whatsoever. And this is because the creators said they wanted to eventually move the setting from Rome to Palestine, or Judea, I suppose, the province of Judea. And one of the co-creators said that the second season was supposed to end with the death of Brutus. Seasons 2 and 3 would take place almost entirely in Egypt, and season 5 would be about the Messiah in Palestine. So they had to cram 2 seasons worth of content into the back half of season 2, and it really, really shows.
Yep.
The pace gets breakneck, and even just these character changes that are breakneck. Like, Varinus is all over the map, from murder gangster, and then they try and do a really slapdash redemption arc at the end for this character.
Hulo gets a brain transplant.
Yeah.
Yeah, they just scoop one brain out and put a different, much smarter brain into Pullo, and then said, why don't you go keep being the same character, but with a much smarter brain?
Yes. And HBO at least took some lessons from this. This show was famously ludicrously expensive. That's a huge part of the reason they canceled it. But DVDs of the show came out later and helped HBO recoup some of that loss. And had they been releasing the DVDs as it came out, who knows? We might have gotten more Rome. But something as banal as how people were watching it, HBO learned from this. Like, their model is about buzz, critical buzz especially. That's why they let The Wire run for 5 seasons, even though not a lot of people were watching it. It had a lot of critical buzz. Critical buzz is fine as long as it's cheap, generally. And I think what they learned after Rome with the DVD sales is that they can take risks on high budget things with high production costs, so long as they can recoup some of their losses. And I think it taught them to be patient, right? I think it taught them, like, Game of Thrones became this runaway freight train for them. Others have observed this. I think it's the last show that virtually everyone watched, like a real monoculture water cooler show. And Game of Thrones broke the record for the most expensive show of all time that was set by HBO's Rome. So I don't think it's a stretch to say that we don't get Game of Thrones without HBO's Rome, without them testing the waters of this high budget sword and sandal period piece prestige drama.
Yeah. And one of the problems for me when I go out there into the world to try to sell my own high concept, high budget HBO-esque series of set in Rome is that the takeaway still from buying executives, kind of people you're pitching this to, is that HBO's Rome was a huge debacle and that it was a giant financial mess and nobody wants to green light anything like that again because of the fact that the big lesson was an almost bankrupted HBO gets built up in the retelling. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult to sell Roman stuff to people unless somebody like Ridley Scott wants to do it. Ridley Scott can do whatever he wants, but somebody like they're going to be like, no, we don't want to do your thing because we know that what's going to happen is it's going to be ludicrously expensive and we're not going to recoup as much as we would like to. Now, if you put some dragons in it and make it CGI, like, are there dragons in your Rome show? Like, no, there's not dragons in my Rome show there. But I am willing to sell out at this point because I do have two kids. So if you want dragons in the Rome show and that's going to get me $1 million an episode, like, I'll do that.
There's a dragon story in one of the lost books of Livy.
They do talk about some dragons in North Africa. That's true.
So we can make it work. But yeah, you've hit a note that we've kind of talked about a lot, which is the trend since the 2000s in movie making is the things that studios want is guaranteed predictable revenue. Mm-hmm. So they're willing to spend $250 million on a Spider-Man or an MCU because franchises tend to be predictable because you've done it before. But they want to minimize risk at all costs. And we suffer as consumers of content for it.
And even this Barbie movie, right, which is a completely bonkers thing that she made that is not like really anything. It's kind of been out there. It feels very new, but it's based off of arguably the single most recognizable toy in American culture and even in world culture. So yeah, even then we're a little bit trapped here.
Trapped in the IP cycle.
But that's okay because I have lots of IP from the Revolutions podcast and from the History of Rome podcast, and podcasting is hip and cool. Have you ever heard of Serial?
Yeah.
That's a very popular show. This is that's like a 10-year-old elevator pitch moment trying to get somebody interested in green lighting $100 million for something based off of a podcast. I never got it made, guys. I still have all the notes, but nobody's
maybe if instead of pitching the Julius Caesar story as the story about the historical figure, you pitched it as the gritty origin story of the mascot for the Little Caesars franchise, you know, like pick the more recognizable figure.
Right. That's true. If I was pitching it as a Little Caesars movie,
right,
I would be able to do better than pitching like this is one of the most famous people on earth. Like everybody kind of knows who Julius Caesar is. You know, like The Storm Before the Storm was translated into Chinese and into Turkish. Julius Caesar as an individual is one of the most recognizable. But of course, what I was telling people is that Caesar doesn't appear in this show at all. This all happened. They're like, oh, is Julius Caesar in this? I'm like, no, he's not even born yet. Like, what are you talking about? No, I'm introducing.
This is like it's like the Batman Begins of Caesar, if you will. Or
he would show up at the very end. Yeah, joining the League of Shadows, right?
Yeah. My favorite Caesar story that I would love to see on film sometime is, of course, the story of him and the pirates, where when Julius Caesar was a young man, he was abducted by pirates and they had a ransom for him. And being an imperious noble Roman, he said that the ransom wasn't high enough and he insisted that they demand a higher ransom for him. And, you know, he's exercising with them on the deck. Julius Caesar's a badass, so he's fitting in with these pirates, but he keeps joking that he's going to crucify them once he comes back. And then his family scrounges up the money, more money, thanks to Julius Caesar's negotiation, pays the ransom, and Julius Caesar goes back and does that. He finds his old captors, defeats them, and crucifies them. At like, I think he's like in his late teens or early 20s at this point. He's very young.
For years and years, and you can throw this in your missed opportunities for culture, there was going to be a young Caesar movie starring Mark Wahlberg.
Whoa.
Damn.
So we were all denied Mark Wahlberg as young Caesar, which I think we can all agree is a travesty for culture. Because, man, what a field day we would have with that one.
Hey, too, Brutus? You gotta be kidding me.
Yeah, as long as he does Caesar with a Boston accent, I'm just gonna be... Just play him as a Southie, please.
Yeah. Mani Vici Dici. I did it all.
Oh my God, what are you even doing, you guys?
Say hi to your paterfamilias for me, yeah?
Yeah, but that didn't go anywhere. The other big one, and this one I actually do lament, is that Vin Diesel spent like 10 years. He might even still be trying to do it, making this Hannibal movie that has never gone anywhere. And so the fact that we never got Vin Diesel's, Vin Diesel's Hannibal is a great sort of loss.
I heard, and this is one of those like through the grapevine things, that he threw it out when he realized that they couldn't record the whole thing in Punic. He wanted to do like Passion of the Christ style.
God, he's such a weird guy. love the Diesel.
Our next two episodes are on Troy and Rome, and these two pieces of media are on sort of two sides of the same coin, and one is very good and one is very bad. And then in our next episode, hopefully get into what makes Troy so bad on the opposite side. So this is a show that has great characterization compared to like Troy's cardboard cutout characters. We have people like Anthony, Caesar, Augustus, all having very separate, distinct characters in the story. And then making up historical characters in Pullo and in Varinus, which are awesome.
Yeah, and then you also have characters that are amalgams of three different people. Because the Romans, they didn't have a lot of names. I think this is part of the problem. There were so many reused names among the ancient Romans. So they amalgamized like three different women into one character, for instance, to kind of streamline the story. I think one of the few things you can say is kind of decent about Troy is that it does have some pretty good action choreography. And HBO's Rome is a show that pretty much jettisons a lot of these big set piece battle scenes. So it's another area in which they're Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde of one another.
Yeah.
And then even just little things. Troy has this stacked cast of professional actors who are all phoning it in. Peter O'Toole apparently walked off the set on the first day, whereas Rome is mostly relative unknowns at the time who absolutely crush. And I guess finally, you can even say in terms of scope, this is a mini series. Well, it wasn't meant to be a mini series. It was meant to be five seasons, but it got canceled. But this is a show that covers decades of history in 22 episodes, whereas Troy condenses the 10-year Trojan War into what is like a weekend, but the movie's still 2 hours and 40 minutes long. It's still too long.
Okay, so yeah, that wraps us up. Thank you so much for joining us and talking about HBO's Rome. I can't tell you how many vacations I've spent listening to the History of Rome podcast, so thank you so much. It's always been so great to revisit it and take it on vacation with me.
Well, thank you. And you know, like I said at the beginning, I'm pitching a third book right now that'll be about the crisis of the third century, and so I'm back with my old Roman friends again and enjoying it very much. They just fit like the most comfortable pair of shoes I've ever worn in my life,
or perhaps sandals. Cali guy.
Yeah, well, absolutely anachronistic sandals. That, you know, like, why is Mike Duncan wearing the wrong kind of sandals? If anybody should know what kind of sandals the Romans wore, it should be Mike Duncan. But I don't, guys. I'm really hip to the politics of the thing, but I'm not sure what was on their feet. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Also, for any fans that are interested, Ben had a million thoughts on the historical accuracy of every episode, and I thought they were super interesting. So if you want, I will put those up on the website in the show notes, and they're organized episode by episode if you want to read through them.
As always, thank you for joining us. Please like, subscribe to this podcast. Once again, thank you to our guest Mike Duncan for coming on, talking about two very different historical adaptations from the 2000s.
Yes, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, we'll catch you next time.
And I think we've mixed in the plugs for the most part throughout the entire episode, but if there's anything else, you know, feel free to, Hero of Two Worlds, Sword Before the Storm, and the Revolutions podcast.
Listen to the Revolutions podcast, listen to the History of Rome, and then I'll be back. I haven't gone anywhere.
Love
awesome,
it.
I can't wait. Cool.
All right.
All right, thanks so much. Talk to you later, guys.
All good?
Catch you.
Awesome, guys. Stop thanks so much. Bye.
Thank you.